This is lesson number 52 in our Bible survey section of the Bible Institute of Correspondence. And in this lesson, we're dealing with the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Now, you will recall that in the previous lesson, we focused upon the rebuilding of the temple. And the temple was rebuilt with considerable adversity. Nevertheless, God moved in the adversity both in the hearts of the people as well as the people around them, defeating that adversity and bringing about the completion of the building of the temple. We come now to the issue of the walls, because with the temple completed and the worship of Jehovah God resumed in the city of Jerusalem, it would be very obvious that there would be a great deal of resentment by the Gentiles around them and a great deal of profaning of holy things by the presence of the Gentiles and the idolatry that would be inherent in them. So the issue of the walls becomes a very important consideration. I have assigned you for reading in preparation for this lesson Nehemiah chapter 1 through Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 20, Nehemiah chapter 4 verses 1 through 23, and Nehemiah chapter 13 verses 1 through 31. Now, this would be an absolute minimum of reading for you to be able to understand what I'm dealing with here. Obviously, I cannot read all of these verses of Scripture on this tape. If I did, I would have no time for anything except the reading of these Scriptures. I would seriously recommend to the person who says, I not only want to pass my test in Bible survey, but I want to get a really good Bible education, I would seriously suggest that you read the book of Isaiah the book of Nehemiah very, very carefully. And I would personally recommend that you read it through at least twice before you enter into the study of this outline. Now, the rebuilding of the walls around Jerusalem is the source of some confusion to a good many Bible students. And this is especially true in the area of eschatology. They tend to confuse this with the building of the temple. In other words, when they talk about or they read about Nehemiah building the walls, they assume that this went in connection with the building of the temple, and thus they find a great deal of difficulty with the 70 weeks of Daniel. Once you get this straight as concerning the time relativity to the building of the temple and the building of the walls, a lot of the apparent problems that men seem to find with the 70 weeks of Daniel will just fade away. Now, while some improvement may possibly have been done upon the city in general during the time of the temple rebuilding, and no doubt some was done upon homes and things of that sort, but while some was done during that period of time, Daniel chapter 9 and verse 25 should be seen as applying to Nehemiah 1:1 through Nehemiah 6:15, rather than the first chapter of Ezra. Now let me show you what I'm talking about. Daniel chapter 9 and verse 25 says, "Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and to rebuild Jerusalem unto the Messiah, the Prince, shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks, and the street shall be built again and the wall, even in troublous times." Now, if you try to start with the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem unto the time of Christ, and you try to place that at the building of the temple, you're going to have a difficult time with it. But if you relate it to the rebuilding of the walls, which actually was the completion mark of this, then again, those difficulties will tend to just fade away. So when you read Daniel chapter number 9, verse 25, do not connect it with the decree of Cyrus that the temple in Jerusalem should be rebuilt, but equate it to the decree in the first chapter of Nehemiah, or in the book of Nehemiah, that the walls should be rebuilt during the time of Nehemiah. The rebuilding of these walls was a definite statement against the heathenism that was taking place on the outside and, of course, was bleeding over to the into the interior of Jerusalem. And it was a significant victory for the Hebrew remnant. Now, if you read, as you begin to read the book of Nehemiah, you're going to find that part of the report that came back to Nehemiah was that the remnant that was in Jerusalem was living in great difficulty and reproach. And part of the reason for that difficulty and reproach was set forth very clearly as being the fact that the walls were broken down and that the gates were burned with fire. So this is a very significant issue. And in the process of this lesson, I want to deal with four different things. The first of them is the time of the rebuilding of the walls. A great many Old Testament doctrines are confused because we become confused about the time in which they took place. For instance, the Bible tells us in the book of Exodus that the children of Israel that who were in Egypt sojourned, had a sojourn of 430 years. Now, many times people read that very, very carelessly, and they understand it to be saying that the children of Israel sojourned 430 years in Egypt. They did not sojourn 430 years in Egypt. The sojourn that was mentioned there included Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's time in the land of Canaan, which was 215 years, and the final 215 years in the land of Egypt. And you'll have great difficulty with dates and times if you go to the trouble of studying them at all until you digest that. But once you get that time period straight in your mind, then the difficulty begins to fade away. And so it is with the rebuilding of the city and the rebuilding of the walls. Now, the first of the remnant returned to build the temple, not the walls, but the temple, in about 536 B.C., Please remember now that you're not counting upward as you count these years. You're counting downward. The first of the remnant returned to rebuild the temple in about 536 B.C., about 70 years after Daniel's captivity. I expect, though I am not 100% sure, but I'm relatively certain, that Daniel personally was among that first group to return out of Persia to come back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. We do know that he went all of the way through. He continued all the way through the 70 years of captivity and return. Now, the temple construction started at about that time, about 536 B.C. But the construction was soon halted because of adversity. Now, we can find this in the book of Ezra, chapter number 4, verses 23 and 24. Now, when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe, and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force and power. Then ceased the work of the house of God which was at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And so you understand that this construction did not go on very long, and it was ceased until about 520 B.C. That means that for a period of approximately 16 years, that these people who had gone to Jerusalem to build the temple were not allowed to build the temple. Now, you understand that in that day and time, you didn't just get on the telephone or send a telegram or crank up your trusty old fax machine, or you didn't flip on your computer and check your email each morning to get these messages through. In order for messages to travel, they had to be taken by personal courier. And if I was governor of a particular province or area, and I had an interest in having things a certain way, and that interest was threatened by a courier passing through my province with a message, he didn't get through. And if you shot him or hung him or took him and put him in prison, there was really no problem. As the governor of the province, you probably would not get caught in doing that. So it is not unbelievable that for 16 years this could be halted without the error of it or the offense of it ever getting back to the king of Persia. But the fact of the matter is that during this period of time, there is actually a change of guard, so as to speak. And when this was re-begun or restarted, the new king had to read the laws or the decrees of the past. And when he did so, he was astonished and he said, "Hey, this building is supposed to go on. Let's get back with the program." But it was actually delayed for about 16 years from 536 B.C. to 520 B.C. and was completed about 4 years later. Only about 4 years for it to be completed, and it was completed in about 516. Now, you want to notice the way that I so profusely use the word about. When we go back to dates like this, sometimes they are very, very difficult to nail down to a particular year because you have some differences with varying calendars. But be sure of this, that those differences will never amount to more than about 3 years. And usually, when one person who is doing the dating accepts the earlier of those 3 years, all of the rest of his dating will be relevant to that. And even though he may be wrong when he puts 520 B.C. on it, he usually will be right on the money when he talks about how long it took for something to be done, because he is not looking at the relativity between 520 B.C. And the actual time, but between 520 B.C. and 516 B.C. as he is dating it. So don't allow yourself to think that because there is some disagreement or technical doubt as to what these dates were, that would be 520 as compared to 523 B.C., that there's a significant doctrinal problem created by it. It simply does not exist. It would only be whether this event started in 536 B.C., or 533 B.C., etc., etc. You're going to find that that problem will exist even in the carrying away of the children of the people of Judah into Babylonian captivity. For instance, there are those who think that Daniel was carried into captivity about 607 B.C., but that ranges all the way back, in the opinion of others, to 604 B.C., But if you take any of those students or scholars of the Bible that arrive at those dates and then look at the other events compared to that particular date, they will line up relatively, so it isn't a great deal of problem. Now, having said that the temple was completed in about 516 B.C., let me point out that the reconstruction of the walls under the direction of Nehemiah began in about 445 B.C., and this is 71 years after the temple was completed. And understanding that will help you a great deal in alignment as to the prophecies of Daniel and several things that relate to eschatology. Ezra the scribe, who wrote of the rebuilding of the temple, was not present with the first group that went up to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. Knowing that will also help you somewhat. Now, he wrote of the rebuilding of the temple and of so much disorder during that time, but he actually came to Jerusalem in about 558 B.C. And so he was there considerably before the beginning of the building, the actual building of the temple. I'm sorry, that is a mistake. That should not be 558 B.C. That should be about 458 B.C., only about 13 years before Nehemiah came. Let me correct that in your mind. I said that he actually came to Jerusalem about 558 B.C., but it was about 458 B.C. That he came to Jerusalem quite some time after the building of the temple was complete. Now remember that Ezra was not a builder, he was a scribe, and he wrote down the history of the things that had been done. And he arrived only about 13 years before Nehemiah, and it may well be that part of Ezra's party returned to Shushan the palace, and that was the occasion of Nehemiah's information concerning the terrible disarray of the city of Jerusalem, and specifically that grievous fact that reached his ears that the walls were broken down and the gates were burned with fire. Now let's come to the second point in this lesson, and that is the purpose of the rebuilding of the walls. Why did they need the walls anyhow? You're quite familiar with the fact that in those days the walls of the city were probably the greatest military insurance that they had. They built walls so that armies didn't just march up and knock on the door of their houses. They first had to not only break down the walls, but before and after they did that, they had to overcome a goodly number of soldiers. However, you understand that Jerusalem is still in subjugation, and they never were really otherwise after the fall of Solomon's household. But after the carrying away by the Assyrians and then the Babylonians. But nevertheless, they are still not a sovereign nation. They are there to build the walls and to build the build the temple by the leave of a heathen or a Gentile king. And so the idea of building the walls was a marvelous thing to a lot of people. Why do these people want walls? The question that came to their mind, or are they going to rebel? Now, the problem was not that they wanted to rebel. The problem was not that they were building walls in order to preclude the observation of the nation of Persia. But the absence of the walls subjected the worship in the temple and the Jewish ordinances that were involved in that to a great deal of reproach. The Gentiles on the outside hated all of this. They didn't believe in it. They didn't see any importance in it, and they had no reverence for it. In your Bibles, if you will, look back again at Nehemiah chapter 1 and verse number 3. This is what the message Nehemiah got. And they said unto me, the remnant that are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Now, notice how that the reproach, the affliction and the reproach go together with the walls being broken down and the gates being burned with fire. So this is a very, very serious situation as far as the Jews are concerned. Such people as Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian were using the city for unholy commerce and profit. If you would look back through the history of Christendom at the huge amounts of money that Catholicism has made off of the religion of so-called Christian people through commerce, you would be just amazed. I was in Mexico some years ago, back in the early 70s, and I was taken into a temple and told by the missionary who was my host there at the time that this one little obscure temple in sort of an out-of-the-way place along a highway in Puebla, Mexico, I believe it was in the state of Puebla, had more gold in it, in this temple, than the entire personal wealth of the people of that state. Now, this was a Catholic temple. Many of the Catholic temples that I saw were just crowned with gold. The Catholic Church made fortunes in Mexico through religious involvement. That is not an extraordinary thing. You remember that when the Lord Jesus Christ came on the scene at the temple in Jerusalem, that he found men there who were money changers, and they also were selling sacrifices and apparently the animals, the birds and so on, for sacrifices at exorbitant prices. And many of these sacrifices were not proper. They were not suitable sacrifices. And so these men were thieves and robbers, but at the same time, they were doing very well. And so it was with Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem. They were very involved in unholy commerce in the city of Jerusalem, and they were doing well at it. They did business on the Sabbath days. This, of course, was not supposed to be done. They profiteered on temple sacrifices. For instance, is a dove worth, in our own language today, is a dove worth a dollar? Okay, for the sake of convenience, you pay $2 here. And they did that continually. And so that was their business, and they really did well at it. In general, they made merchandise of holy things. They put no difference between the profane and the holy, because to them none of this was holy. It was just business in general. And so I think you can immediately see and quite readily understand why these men would not want a wall built around Jerusalem. But at the same time, you could equally as easily see why men who did reverence the things of God would want the walls built. All of this confusion and this reproach and this ungodly conduct greatly promoted things that were hurtful to the whole purpose of the remnant's return. Why did they return? Why did God move in the heart of Darius to send them back? So they could have the great privilege of living in Jerusalem? So they could build their house on the spot that their father's house had been built on? Though they may have done those things, that wasn't why they returned. They were returned to build the house of God, and that house of God was to be built for the purpose of the glory of God. And so all of these things that were going on were hurtful to that. The same idolatry that had caused them to be carried away was now being broadly practiced right in the land to which God had restored them. Notice in Ezra chapter 9 and verse 5. And at the evening sacrifice, I rose up from my heaviness. This is Ezra speaking, the scribe now. And having rent my garment and my mantle, I fell on my knees and spread out my hands unto the Lord my God, and said, O my God, I am ashamed and blush to lift up my face to thee, my God. For our iniquities are increased over our head, and our trespass is grown up under the heaven. Since the days of our fathers have we been in a great trespass unto this day. And for our iniquities have we, our kings and our priests, been delivered into the hand of the kings of the land, to the sword, to captivity, and to spoil, and to confusion of face, as it is this day. And now, for a little space, grace hath been showed from the Lord our God, to leave us a remnant to escape, and to give us a nail in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a little reviving in our bondage. For we were bondmen, yet our God hath not forsaken us in our bondage, but hath extended mercy unto us in the sight of the kings of Persia, to give us a reviving, to set up the house of our God, and to repair the desolations thereof, and to give us a wall in Judah and in Jerusalem. And now, O Lord our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken thy commandments, which thou commanded by thy servants the prophets, saying, the land unto which ye go to possess it is an unclean land, with the filthiness of the people of the lands with their abominations, which have filled it from one end to the other with their uncleanness. So he's saying, Lord, you sent us into the land of Canaan, and you told us that it was an unclean land, and you purged it out, and then you delivered us into bondage for our sins. And now you, by your grace, have brought us back. And what do we have going on here? The same kind of hybrid conduct and adulterous conduct that was taking place in the land of Canaan from the time the people went in to possess it. And so this was the problem that these people were dealing with, a very, very serious thing. And it was seen in a good many different ways. Not only the idolatry that had carried them away was now being again respected and practiced. That would be like the people in the groves and all of those things. That was being practiced. But there was a neglect of divine ordinances. The things God had told them to do, they were just grossly neglecting them. For instance, in Nehemiah chapter number 13 and verse number 4, Nehemiah begins to list, and I do not have time to enumerate all of these things, but he lists the things that were wrong. And he said, before this, Eliashib the priest, having the oversight of the chamber of the house of God, was allied to Tobiah, means he had made friends with him, and he had prepared for him a great chamber where aforetime they laid the meat offerings and frankincense. Now notice this, here is a place that had to do with offerings, and he has prepared a chamber here for this Gentile thief, and the vessels and the tithes of the corn, the new wine, the oil, which was commanded to be given to the Levites and the singers and the porters and the offerings of the priests. But in all this time was not I at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, came I unto the king. After certain days I obtained I leave of the king, and I came to Jerusalem, and understood of the evil of Eliashib, the evil Eliashib did for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me sore, therefore I cast forth all the household stuff of Tobiah out of the chamber. Then I commanded that they cleanse the chambers, and thither brought I again the vessels of the house of God with the meat offering and the frankincense. And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them, for the Levites and singers that did the work were fled every one to his field. Then contended I with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn. And he goes on to explain the things that have been taken care of. So we see here how they had neglected these divine ordinances. I'd like to go ahead and read all those verses and give you a little bit of exposition, but time will not allow it. But we just see how they had neglected the ordinances. But that's not all. There was also the intermarriage with Gentiles. In Ezra chapter 9 and verse 1, now when these things were done, the princes came to me saying, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the people of the land, doing according to their abominations, even of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Jebusites and Amorites and Moabites and Egyptians and the Amorites. For they have taken their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed, notice that, even the holy seed, the tribe of Judah, have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and the rulers hath been chief in this trespass. And in Ezra chapter number 10 and verse number 10, he goes on to explain the same thing and how that God ordained a remedy for this problem. So you see here the problems that were involved because the walls did not exist. The walls not only brought about something of physical separation, but it implied a proper separation between the Gentiles of the land. And these people were fully and totally neglecting that. So the walls were for the purpose of not only teaching this separation, but also to a great extent enforcing it. Now you can understand if these Gentiles were enjoying these privileges, right or wrong, profiting from them, right or wrong, that they were going to object to anything that threatened those privileges. And so you find in the third place, and the thing that I want to draw your attention to now, the opposition to the building of the walls. If I am doing business on your property, and you propose to build a wall around it that is automatically going to exclude me from that property, I'm not going to like that very much, because it means that my business is going to be threatened. And that's exactly what these people realized. It was well known by the intruding Gentiles such as Sanballat and Tobiah that the existence of the walls would hurt their commerce. It was not going to be good for their business. In the first place, they said, well, if nothing else goes wrong, even if they let us in, and even if they do not make us change the things that we're selling, they're going to close the gates on the Sabbath. They're not going to let us come in and do business on the Sabbath, because that was part of their business, part of what they were enjoying. And so they very definitely objected, because they knew that it would hurt their commerce. They therefore sought to halt this work by several avenues of endeavor. In the first place, they thought of themselves as being big shots, so they just tried to ridicule the Jews and get them, you know, to be embarrassed and to walk away in embarrassment. If you notice in Nehemiah chapter 2 and verse 19, the Bible says, but when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Amorite, and Gershom the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, what is this thing you do? Will you rebel against the king? Now, this was not only a ridicule, but it was also something of a covert threat, because the suggestion that they might be rebelling against the king implied that such a message as this might well be delivered to the king. Hey, these people are building a wall so that they can rebel. So they use this means of trying to stop them from building, just the ridiculing. Secondly, they did so by conspiracy to fight against them. In Nehemiah chapter number 4 and verses 1 through 3, we find them saying, but it came to pass when Sanballat heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth and took great indignation and mocked the Jews. And he spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish which are burned? In other words, he is ridiculing here. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was by him, and he said, even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and that the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them. And Judah said, the strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed. There is much rubbish, so that we are not able to build the wall. And our adversaries said, they shall not know, neither see, till we come in the midst among them and slay them and cause the work to cease. So they said, now the rubbish that's around here, the building material and the stones that have been taken out of the broken walls and carried away, all of this becomes a fortress or a hiding place for our enemies. And they're saying, we can slip right in among this rubbish and we can kill them and cause the work to cease. So you see, they were very serious about it. Verse 12 says, and it came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, from all places whence ye shall return unto us, they will be upon you. So they were threatening them physically in the process of this work to stop a conspiracy to fight against them. And then thirdly, they sought to seek to join them. If they could join with them, then they could destroy them from the inside. Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 7. We find this very thing being set before them. Now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at that time I had not set up the doors upon the gates, that Sanballat and Gershom sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together
in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono, but they thought to do me mischief. In other words, now they have a conspiracy. And I sent messengers unto them to say to them, I'm doing a great work, so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, it is reported among the heathen, and Geshmu saith it, that thou and the Jews think to rebel, for which cause thou buildest the wall, that thou mayest be their king according to these words. And thou hast also appointed prophets to preach to thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah. And now shall it be reported to the king according to these words. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. And so you see how that they are now seeking not only to conspire against them, to destroy from the inside, but they are also seeking to put pressure on them, political pressure, to force them to do what they want them to do. The world always objects to our efforts for God when they involve proper separation. And let me just say this to you, that down through the ages, one of the most common and efficient tactics of the devil and his adversaries has not been to fight against the Lord's church from the outside. Now, they have done that. Many of God's men have been martyred down through the years, just as surely and even more viciously than was Stephen. That is a fact. But that has not been the greatest, has not been the effort of the greatest efficiency, but in many instances what they have done is the devil's people have joined and have fought from within. They do so through gossip, but probably the most efficient way in the world is through propagating false doctrine or the denial of the importance of doctrine at all. I have to come quickly to the last point, and that is the successful completion of the rebuilding of the walls. The building of the wall was quite an accomplishment considering the circumstances. Number one, the man who led in it was in slavery when he was called. I mean, you think about that. How's this man who is a personal slave to the king in Shushan, how is he just going to walk out of the palace and go about this project? Well, he couldn't do that. So God had to work in the heart of the king. You notice that Nehemiah didn't even bring this up to the king. The king just saw that he was sad and said, Nehemiah, I need to talk to you. What's bothering you? So Nehemiah told him. He said, all right, what do you need? And God just worked that out. So, and not only that, but this man was a slave. He didn't have his own funds. So he was dependent upon his captors for not only permission to go, but substance with which to build. And again, God moved in their heart, and that was provided. Thirdly, he had opposition from the enemies of the work. Now, Nehemiah was not a trained warrior. I don't know where he got his military strategy, but I'll tell you what I expect. I expect that it came directly from God, and he had good strategy. And they worked with a trowel in one hand and the sword in another hand while they were in the process of building the wall. So the building of this wall was an extremely wonderful accomplishment when we consider all of the things that they had going against them. God moved upon the king of Persia to send the man and to furnish the money and to furnish the material. I recall your attention to Nehemiah chapter 2, verses 7 through 9. Moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over till I come to Judah. In other words, give me safe passage. And a letter unto Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make the beams for the gates of the palace, which appertain to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house, and I shall enter in, And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Notice that. The king granted according to the good hand of God upon me. Then I came to the governors beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. Isn't that something? That this king heard the petition of a cupbearer, just a lowly house servant. But God moved in the king's heart, and the king not only heard the petition, but he granted the petition, and things worked out as they were supposed to. You can look, if you would, at the truths of this. They just bounce out to us, and we see them everywhere. God overruled and He overpowered all the obstacles, all of the opposition, whether it was resistance physically or whether it was just ridicule. In Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 7 and 8, we read these words, "But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and the breaches began to be stopped, they were very wroth, and they conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and to hinder it." Didn't do any good. They couldn't stop these people because the good hand of God was upon them. The same thing is brought out in Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, and I think we read that to you a moment ago. Now, I want to give you something that you may not be aware of, and I think this is wonderful. These walls were built in only 52 days in spite of these troublous times. God is able. How we need to remember that when God has told us what to do and how to do it, we must not be turned aside by the ridicule of the world around us or the apparent impossibilities that seem to exist out there, but we need to go forth and do what God had said. During this time, there was a great deal of other reform which took place, and I do not have time to mention it, but you can read Nehemiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 19, and you'll find that Nehemiah did a good many other things to reform the terrible situation. Actually, that was sort of symbolized and even encouraged by the absence of the wall. Nehemiah governed Judah for 12 years after the walls were complete, and then he returned to Shushan the palace. And this was according to his agreement with the king. He had asked for this length of time, and this servant got a leave of 12 years and went to Jerusalem and built these walls and straightened out a lot of the problems. Now, I don't have time to show you the times there, but if you would read Nehemiah 2:1, Nehemiah 5:14, Nehemiah 13:6, and make a comparison of these dates and times, you'll find that Nehemiah was there with the king's leave for 12 years and then returned to Shushan as the slave that he had been before. Later, he returned to Jerusalem. God mightily used this man, though he was only a lowly servant in the house of a heathen king. May God bless you.